You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, the Biden administration has continued tariffs on Chinese imports that were put in place by the Trump administration. U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo said this week that the U.S. Trade Representative's office is reviewing those tariffs to evaluate their effectiveness, but that the White House has no plans to change them at this time. The continuing tariffs on China are just one example of where President Biden has taken a different approach on trade compared to the Obama and Clinton administrations. Biden has also shied away from striking new trade deals and invested more in domestic manufacturing, energy, and infrastructure compared to previous Democratic administrations that leaned more on international commerce. We're learning more about how U.S. trade policy has shifted over time and how that could shape debate over the economy heading into the 2024 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the way Biden has handled trade policy? Do you want to see tariffs on China remain in place? How do you feel about the investments in manufacturing and infrastructure? How about things like supporting microchip manufacturing here in the country, trying to lower dependence on foreign sources? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Avik Chakravarti is an associate professor of economics at UW-Milwaukee, where he researches international trade and finance. He's a faculty affiliate at the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute. Avik, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Big picture, Avik, how do you look at the Biden administration, how it's approached trade policy? What has struck you over the last couple of years?
Well, like you said, I think every listener of yours, as well as those who are eager to see the America First agenda that President Trump had put in place. We see some very encouraging trends in the current administration that has definitely distinctively deviated from what we had seen before President Trump. And the idea is the only way that a country can be put first, a country as prosperous as the United States, is by making sure that other countries do not take advantage of it. So I think that what President Trump had put forward is an agenda that's coming to fruition. And I think that irrespective of any political outcome, President Trump's initiatives will show over time to be very, very effective. And I think that, you know, future presidents from either party we'll have to embrace it like we see President Biden embracing it during his first term.
Yeah, President Trump talked more, I think, and more loudly about his changes to trade policy. Have you seen much change, though, from the Trump to Biden administrations on this issue, on things like tariffs and protectionism?
What we have seen in terms of changes, if we look through a microscope, if you will, is most recently, if you look at just before the political trips to China. If you look at the economics of it, you notice that some key sectors, like technological sectors, are going to be affected even more than before through President Biden's executive order. And the only distinction you see is in terms of focus on sectors. For example, if you look at computing chips or quantum technology as a broader term, or artificial intelligence, microelectronics, these are places where we are seeing greater emphasis, more targeted emphasis. However, that said, though, I have to say that when President Trump talked about all of these in the aggregate, it was the earliest credible signal being sent to our then largest trading partner, now probably in the third place after Mexico and Canada, which is China now, which recently been ranked third rather than first. But overall, the idea that President Trump put forward through his dialogues and efforts to diplomatically resolve the disputes with China were very much in line with what we are seeing today, with even more focused, even more forceful, forceful impositions of restrictions. And my prediction during President Trump's tenure was that had he been in office today, we would have seen similar, if not stronger, restrictions on China.
Talking to Avik Chakrabarti from UW-Milwaukee, Associate Professor of Economics there, looking at U.S. trade policy. some common themes in the Trump and Biden administration's departures from what we had seen from Democrats and Republicans in the years before that. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Avik, I think there was a consensus maybe before the 2016 election. There's a debate between the idea of, okay, we want free trade that might hurt some American manufacturing, but it'll bring benefits to consumers in terms of cheaper goods, versus no, the priority should be protecting American manufacturing. Leading Democrats and Republicans went for that free trade formula. Now we saw Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump in 2016 arguing against it. Now Biden, as you suggest, joining them. What do you think led people to move in that direction?
See, we always needed a very effective leader like President Trump to come in and make it clear to the public that the United States was being taken advantage by other countries in various forms, including countries in Europe. So we shouldn't single out China, but the point is that economically speaking, on the trade platform, China, whether we strongly use the word taking advantage or they were simply pushing their Make China Great agenda, but President Trump brought back Make America Great Again, in the sense that somehow the leaders in this country at various levels, local all the way up to the national levels, were apparently becoming oblivious of the fact that there were trade agreements with other countries, including this Section 301 that President Trump boldly brought back into our limelight, is that many aspects of this Trade Act of 1974. So this goes back so many decades. Like we're talking about an era where many of our listeners may not even been interested in economics and politics. But in 1974, we had this agreement, which was greatly violated by many countries. And the reason China comes to limelight is because China became the largest trading partner with the United States, and we had the largest trade deficit. So the question was, how can we reduce our dependence on one country, diversify our trade, but most importantly, level the playing field? And without President Trump's bringing this into the limelight, I think that we would still be wondering why were there such strict tariffs, such sudden imposition of restrictions on a single country like China. Why was it important? And this is the importance of it, that we need to level the playing fields. If we want free trade like those who saw before President Trump, we also need fair trade. We need other countries to free up their trade too, if they want to freely trade with us. That's pretty much the message that President Trump sent, and I think that any administration, including the current, would continue to send in the near future.
There were concerns during the Trump administration about retaliation. So, you know, some farmers here in Wisconsin may have had less favorable opportunities to sell to China than they had previously. The idea that, you know, we were escalating a trade war, in effect, that was hurting all sides. Did you see some of that happening?
Absolutely, absolutely. And see, this is why having an economically highly sophisticated mind in the White House was important. So while we saw President Trump as our political leader, we also saw an economic mind at work. So it was difficult to fool President Trump through Washington politics. So he understood that there would be retaliation, because it's impossible to not have retaliation from the world's soon to become maybe the largest economy in the world, surpassing us, China, not population-wise, of course, but population-wise, India is the largest economic democracy that you can imagine. But in terms of economic power, you have China, right? They're competing neck to neck with the United States, and retaliation was definitely anticipated. So what President Trump did was he essentially said, okay, fine, I mean, if you hurt our farmers, we will subsidize our farmers using the tariff money, the revenue that we have through these tax impositions, which are called tariffs in international economics. No difference between tariffs and taxes, it's just on foreign producers. And once you take the money from foreign producers, give it to our farmers, that signals to foreign countries that if you keep doing it, if you retaliate, we will be doing enough to help our segments of the population that are being hurt. At the same time, we want to keep in mind that President Trump also clearly saw that because we import so much more from China, like if you think about even, modified figures, we are looking at almost four times the amount of values of imports that were hurt by tariffs by President Trump's initiative on China, whereas China could only retaliate by imposing tariffs to the extent of a couple of hundred billion or shy of that. We had more than $550 billion worth of goods from China that were being affected. So China was going to be affected by more because it would soon run out of options to impose retaliations on us. And that's clearly because we were running such a large deficit with China. So I think all of these went into the calculation when President Trump went ahead and initiated this this signal, if you will, which the Biden administration is carrying through till date, with small reversals. You know, if you notice, there's been a little bit of softening in the tone with the three visits to China, one political visit, one military visit, and one most recent economic visit, that we think we are trying to soften a little bit. But softening will be effective only if the trading partners, including China, softens their stance as well.
We're talking to UW-Milwaukee economics professor Avik Chakrabarty about how the Biden administration has handled trade policy, how that compares to President Trump and other predecessors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think about President Biden's approach to trade, former President Trump's approach to trade? What would you like to see the White House focus on? Join in at 800-642-1234. Does this affect your livelihood one way or another? 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Avik Chakrabarty, Associate Professor of Economics at UW-Milwaukee, who researches international trade and finance. With us today to look at White House policy on trade, tariffs, China, and domestic investment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's more important to you? Free trade, maybe allowing cheaper consumer goods into the country, or boosting American industry, manufacturing, agriculture? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. It sounds like what Biden did is took some of the parts of the Trump policies that were working out and kept them, and then actually took, in addition to that, care of some issues that Trump wasn't dealing with or was dealing with in a terrible way. I'll say that one of the failures I feel of the Trump administration is that he never put a carbon tariff on China, because China actually puts out more carbon dioxide than the U.S. in terms of global warming. And Biden has not done that, but he has tried to deal with global warming when dealing with other countries. And he's also encouraged domestic investment, so that if we can get our economy to change in time enough, we can avoid some of the worst impacts of global warming. Additionally, I think that Biden just has a better foreign policy, in that NATO is still intact. And if Trump was given a second term, that is very much in question.
Nate, thanks for the call. Avik, I want to zoom in on Nate's idea using trade policy as a tool, a stick, I think, to get other countries to help fight climate change. What do you think of that idea?
Absolutely. That's a very useful idea. But at the same time, I listened to what Nate said, and I, like many who would agree with Nate, that the environment is something for us to protect, not only for us, but for generations to come. And while Nate may not have followed that during Trump administration, and during even before President Trump's administration, during President Trump's administration, and carrying on to President Biden's administration, there is always an overarching concern about the environment. The question is, to what extent do we push the environmental agenda so that we are not hurt immediately without being prepared? For example, take the energy crisis, right? Any intelligent economist or strategist would say that we were not prepared for the energy situation that we're in now. So trying to say that we're saving the environment but then putting more pain, which we did not even take into account, would be not so prudent policy. So I think that the environmental agenda is absolutely justified. It's a long-run perspective we need to take, because remember that the environment was degraded by not by one president, but by many presidents in the past, if you want to blame any president. So when President Trump came in, he was trying to protect our energy sector, where we were trying to become not only self-sufficient, but sometimes to the extent exporting to other nations. This was important not only to make our country more resilient, but also to reduce any kind of dependency that might cause more harm to us, particularly in the strategic sectors. So I agree with Nate that environment is important, and I agree with the components of Biden and President Biden's policies that are protecting the environment. And I think it's in line with President Trump's work as well.
Nate, thanks for the call. Avik, I wanted to get into the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's this idea, again, criticized by then 2016 presidential candidate Bernie Sanders and then candidate Donald Trump, very opposed to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. One of the hopes of supporters was, hey, it's going to bring the United States together and Pacific powers against China in some ways, as a competitor to China. Is there a value in doing some kind of arrangement like that that gives the U.S. and its allies advantages over China as an economic competitor?
Yes, yes. In fact, you know, going back to your reference to President Trump's position on TPP, the Trans-Pacific Agreement Partnership in particular, essentially what President Trump was trying to do is trying to diversify our dependence on other countries. Because when you were dependent on one country like China or, you know, Canada or Mexico at one time, it makes us more vulnerable. So the idea is to diversify as much as possible. And the country that President Trump had in mind, very rightfully so, was India. Because if you look at India and make a comparison with China, India is the largest populous economic democracy that you can see on the face of Earth. So there is, and the young democracy. So if you look at the age composition of Indian population, it's more productive, it's more young. So bringing in India into the picture without having a broader net was the initiative that President Trump took. I remember President Modi, Prime Minister Modi, president here is most powerful. The Prime Minister in India is most powerful. So Prime Minister Modi visited the United States, and there were very good relationships that were being built. And that's been continued over time through this current administration. And like I said, irrespective of political changes, I think that this type of an expansion of relationship between United States and other Asian economies, or trans-Pacific economies, if you will, without needing any new contracts or agreements in place, would be highly welcome. So I think the idea is to replace one country or three countries, like, you know, Canada, Mexico, and China, instead of replacing them entirely, just diversify competition, extending hopefully to at least India, which holds a lot of promise for the rest of the world in generations to come.
Time for one more caller. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I think, you know, you've been praising the Trump administration quite a bit for their economic policies and what a positive effect they have had on America. But a really negative effect on America in his policies was the calling of climate change a hoax, and that ceding that sort of industry to other countries like Denmark and China. And, you know, basically this other policy of including more countries is basically these countries are used for cheap labor. So we have a poorer working class that can afford cheap products from China and India and other nations.
Willem, thanks for the call. Which part of that do you want to tackle, Avik? We just have a minute or so left.
Yeah, sure. And let me give me a little raise a flag if I'm going over time. But the way to respond positively to your question, to your caller's question, is to say, look, it takes some time to adjust. So that's my point. So President Trump called the environmental agenda hoax to the extent that it was done without us being prepared to deal with it. So it's one thing to say that he completely was not interested in environment. That is absolutely not true. He did want the environment to become cleaner for
Climate change, he did flat out call it a hoax, a Chinese hoax in some cases.
Yeah, I mean, see, keep in mind that the president of the United States cannot be blamed for everything, but we tend to do that. But what's but essentially what President Trump was trying to do when he called it a hoax is he intended to say that it's being misused by people to reduce the self-sufficiency of certain sectors in the United States. So while the environment needs to be clean, and the climate change has to be brought about, but it should not be turned into a hoax. That's what he meant, to promote certain agenda that are not beneficial to our generation or the future. So I think that, bringing in more countries, the other part of the question, which may have vices, for example, your caller mentioned, like poor lay workers, child workers, of course, those are humanitarian grounds on which we have to be careful. But we need to keep in mind that the reason that people are poor in other countries is because they don't have an option to earn more. So if we trade more with them, they will earn more. They will send less of their children to work and send them to school. So trade is a way of reaching out to countries which are in need for assistance, not foreign aid, but essentially kind of getting into a situation where we can continue to be the leader of the free world.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Avik Chakrabarty, Associate Professor of Economics at UW-Milwaukee, where he researches international trade and finance. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Parrott. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. How and why do we gain weight? And why do we struggle to lose it when we try to? Is it the decisions we make, our lifestyle, our genetics, our willpower, a little bit of everything? Those are questions that have puzzled countless people and motivated medical researchers, as well as pharmaceutical companies, to find answers. New, stronger versions of anti-diabetic drugs are adding a new wrinkle and may help provide some solid explanations for what determines a person's weight and what can be done if weight becomes unhealthy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked with a medical provider on losing weight? Have you had experience with these drugs like Ozempic or Wegovy? Is treatment like that something you've considered for your own health? And what questions do you have about how these medications work, how they fit into issues of weight loss and diabetes? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Lisa Morselli is an assistant professor of medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's interested in weight management, diabetes, and general endocrinology. Her research includes looking at metabolic adaptation to weight loss. Dr. Morselli, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Rob. Thank you for having me.
These drugs like Ozempic that are getting a lot of attention as potential anti-obesity drugs, they came, I understand, as part of an anti-diabetes effort. Can you talk about the origins of these medications? What were they originally intended for?
Yes, so you're right. These drugs were initially developed for diabetes. And interestingly, the first compound was isolated from the saliva of a lizard, poisonous lizard that lives in Arizona. But this compound was found to have an effect on the pancreas, on the part of the pancreas that produces insulin, which is what's lacking or not being produced enough when people have diabetes. And so the first compound was developed in 2005. And then there's been newer compounds that have come out since then. And in addition to improving blood sugars, it was noted that they caused weight loss. And so that's why they've been used also for weight management.
I get, limiting the pancreas's ability to produce insulin. I get why that would help with diabetes. Do we know why these medications are helping with weight loss?
Yes. So they are similar to a hormone that is produced in the gut that works on the pancreas to help with insulin production, but it also works on the centers that control appetite in the brain. And this hormone called GLP-1 or glucagon-like peptide 1 basically makes people less hungry. So that's how then these drugs cause weight loss. And so the effect is in part on the brain and in part by slowing down the emptying of the stomach, which is something that people may have heard in the news. But the main effect is really how it acts on the brain centers that control appetite and hunger.
I mentioned that your research includes looking at metabolic adaptation to weight loss. And I've read about this idea of a set point where whatever weight we might be at, our brains kind of say, okay, yeah, this is how much fat I want the body to have. This is the weight I want. And no matter how hard we try to go below that, if we're trying to, our brain is going to manage our appetite in a way to keep it there. Is that kind of what we're talking about when we talk about metabolic adaptations to when we lose weight?
It's kind of. So, yes. So you're correct that there's now this theory that our bodies want us to be at a certain weight. And that's determined in part by what happens in the brain, because the brain is what controls energy balance. So the balance of energy in and energy out, which is ultimately what defines our weight. And this concept of set point is probably why so many people gain weight and it's so hard to lose it. And we don't really know what's causing that, what's determining that. It's probably a combination of genetics and environmental factors. But metabolic adaptation is basically the response that the body puts into effect when we're trying to lose weight, to fight the weight loss and bring us back to where our body thinks we should be in terms of weight.
Talking to Dr. Lisa Morselli from the Medical College of Wisconsin, looking at our weight, how we manage it, how these new classes of drugs seem to help with weight loss and who they're intended for. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Morselli, I understand you've worked with these medications for years now and with patients. Who would be the most likely candidate to take one of these medications with weight loss in mind?
So in general, we defined, you know, we identify who should be on a weight loss medication based on body mass index, which is a rough measure of if you're overweight or not. And so the guidelines are that if a person has a BMI greater than 30, they can be on a weight loss medication. If they have a BMI greater than 27 and they have some complications due to excess weight, like, for example, diabetes or high blood pressure or high cholesterol, then they also qualify for a weight loss drug. So in my practice, those are the guidelines that I follow. Definitely, these drugs should not be used for people who are not clearly overweight. And we know that there's been a lot of hype in the news and from Hollywood celebrities about these medications. And that has led to many people who maybe should not need a medication to lose weight to want to take them. But yes, if you have if you're clearly overweight and you have potentially complications from this overweight, that's when you qualify for a weight loss drug.
What are some of the health impacts of being overweight or obese?
Well, there are many health adverse health impacts, really. You can have diabetes, you can have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, heart attacks, strokes. You can have joint issues. You can have fatty liver. There's many types of cancers that have now been related to associated with obesity. So the health impact for many people is significant. There are some people who have obesity who don't have any of these issues, but they're really a minority. That's why we recommend weight loss.
Now, we saw an article in the Wall Street Journal. This is part of what made us interested in this conversation. They ran a piece with a headline saying it's biology over willpower. So the idea being that, okay, these drugs are showing that, hey, if you're struggling with your weight, it's not a failure of your willpower. It's It's something about your biology. What do you think about the role of willpower? I think we assume it can do a lot when it comes to our nutrition and our weight loss.
Well, so obviously to lose weight, you have to be in the right place and you have to want to lose weight. But I think that if losing weight was just a matter of putting some willpower into changing how you eat and exercising more, then everybody would be able to do that. And unfortunately, obesity and overweight are still viewed as poor lifestyle choices and character flaws by a lot of people. But in the medical community, in the scientific community, we've known for a long time that there's a lot of biology that drives weight. And in fact, the Obesity Society, which is our professional society, defined obesity as a chronic disease, so a chronic condition like diabetes or high blood pressure, already in 2008. So this is a new concept for the general public, that their weight gain is a matter, not just a matter of willpower, and that biology has a big role, but it's not really new for us obesity practitioners.
We're talking about what controls a person's weight and what new drugs could tell us about the causes of obesity. Dr. Lisa Morselli stays with us, assistant professor of medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about the biology of our weight, of our metabolism? Is healthy weight something you've struggled with yourself? Have you been able to find treatments, lifestyle changes, whatever it might be that worked for you? Are you curious about these drugs you may be seeing headlines about, billed as weight loss medications? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Dr. Lisa Morselli, assistant professor of medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin, talking about what causes people to gain weight and struggle to lose weight if they want to, and what stronger versions of a class of drugs are teaching us about how our metabolisms work. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Bring on a caller. Jennifer is with us in St. Paul. Jennifer, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Jennifer?
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things, the medications that are prescribed and obtained through a compounding facility, or then you get them through the mail versus you're going through the regular clinic and family practice channels. It seems to me like I'm hearing about some of the ladies going to like a medical concierge versus being able to go to their family practice. It's cheaper. And what your thoughts are on that when you just get it delivered to your mail versus through like your local pharmacist.
Thanks for the call, Jennifer. I understand, Dr. Morselli, some of these compounding pharmacies are working with some of the medications we're talking about. I haven't read much about this, but the FDA has given some warnings against turning to some of these drugs. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. I agree with the FDA. The issue with these compounded medications is that we don't really know where they come from. These medications are still under patent, and so there's a concern that maybe the compounds that are used, the drugs that are used to make these medications, are maybe research grade compounds, or they are not. Yes, they are produced in compounding pharmacies, so the safety guidelines should be followed in the preparation, but it's really unclear where these drugs come from, and that's why it's not recommended to turn to that source.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for the call. And Dr. Morselli, as I understand it, a lot of these medications we're talking about, it's not a bottle of pills you take home. These are injections you would receive at a doctor's office in many cases. Can you talk about how we take these medications, how often we have to do it?
So these are injectable drugs. Some are daily injections under the skin, and you they come in a pen device, so you don't need to go to your doctors. You can go, you can give it to yourself. And the other, some are, the newer versions are weekly injections, so you just take them once a week, but it's still a injection under the skin.
And for people who use these medications, you know, for that person who's overweight or obese, has success with these, what happens when they stop, if they stop taking these medications?
Yes, so that's also something that many people don't realize, is that if you start a medication for weight loss, be this, these injectables or other weight loss medications, if they help you by controlling, helping you eating less and controlling your appetite, it's not that once you stop taking the drug, things stay the same. Things will go back to where you were before. So your appetite will be revved up and it will be hard to continue to control your portions and eat reasonable, you know, portions. So these drugs have to be taken long term. And it's not that, you know, you're going to continue to lose weight indefinitely. At some point, things will balance out because, again, the human body has a lot of mechanisms to prevent excessive weight loss. But when we try to lose weight just with diet and exercise, these mechanisms kick in pretty fast. And these drugs overcome these mechanisms for a while, which is why they allow, they help us lose really much larger amount of weight than just we would achieve with just diet and exercise.
Let's go back to our
caller. They have to be taken long term. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Nicolette is with us in Appleton. Nicolette, hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question for Dr. Marcelli is in regards to my specific situation. I've been intrigued by the drugs and, you know, caught off guard a little bit by some of the comments made and observations with celebrities. So I was glad that you touched on that. I've always felt like after my last child that I just had, it's been really hard to come back, and I'm not seeing the same results as easily as I did with my other children. I ended up, you know, it's been about 8 months now, and I've been curious about asking more about these drugs because I feel like nothing is working for me, and I'm working very hard at it, to the point where I feel like I'm almost hurting my body more working physically at it than I ever have before. So I was curious if, you know, post-baby delivery bodies and mothers, if that's like a consideration or a testing that has been looked at and something that I could look into with a doctor.
Nicolette, thanks for the call. And Dr. Marcelli, of course, I won't ask you to diagnose Nicolette in particular or suggest medications or not. But how to evaluate a situation if a patient comes in and says, you know, post-baby weight is Ozempic or Wegovy or one of these medications maybe the right path? What kind of things would you do to evaluate that?
Well, the first thing I would look at is what the person's BMI is, because that's really, you know, these drugs are approved for a certain BMI. And BMI is the body mass index. It's basically a ratio of weight to height that helps us assess if a person is overweight or not. It's not a perfect measure, but that's what we use in clinical practice. And so that would be the first thing that I would look at. And then I would also try to see if there's other factors that can contribute to difficulty losing weight. There's definitely, you know, sleep deprivation is a has a big influence on our weight status. Medications, I would definitely review the person's, you know, eating habits and exercise habits. But it's you know, we need to do a comprehensive evaluation. So definitely your caller should talk with their doctor to see if one of these medications is appropriate, with the idea that this would not be a temporary fix. Mm-hmm. It would probably have to be a long-term medication.
Nicolette, thanks a lot for the call. Talking to Dr. Lisa Marcelli from the Medical College of Wisconsin about weight loss, and the drugs you may have been seeing headlines about. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Marcelli, can you talk about the kinds of side effects we might see with these classes of medications?
Yes. So the Most common side effects that we see are gastrointestinal side effects. So because the initially, especially these drugs do slow down the emptying of the stomach and also how the gut moves. So many people struggle with constipation. It's usually not, you know, it's not a intractable constipation. So if you make sure that you have enough fiber, you drink plenty of water, usually things improve. And then you can have the opposite problem also from constipation. You can have nausea and then reactions at the injection site. So, you know, rash or itching. That is also something that we see. These are the main side effects. And then these drugs can also raise the heart rate. So for most people, that's not an issue. But if you already have a high heart rate to begin with, or if you have some abnormal heart rhythms, those can become worse with these drugs. So that's why it's always good to consult a doctor before starting this type of medications.
And Dr. Morselli, I've read at least anecdotal accounts of patients saying, you know, who are obese, they're using one of these medications, they've been one of the more successful stories, and maybe they're able to stop taking a blood pressure medication or go with a lower dose cholesterol medication. Is that a potential trade-off, even if we worry about some of these side effects?
Absolutely. So the idea of losing weight, it's not just for cosmetic reasons. It's mostly, it should be done for health reasons. And we know, as we mentioned at the beginning of the interview, that excess weight has a lot of consequences on our health. And so definitely any weight loss will make you healthier. But obviously, the more you lose, the more you may be able to shed some of these medications for these conditions that are associated with excess weight. So definitely that's one of the benefits. And I will say that the great majority of people does tolerate these medications well.
Dr. Morselli, in just our last minute or so, you've been working on these issues for some time now. Big picture, how big a deal are these medications? How much does this change the face of weight loss?
Oh, they're a huge deal. Because, you know, so when we talk about weight loss, obviously everybody starts from a different weight. So to kind of standardize things, we talk in terms of percentage of weight loss. And in the past, we considered that a weight loss that would make you significantly healthier is a 5% weight loss. Now with these drugs, many people achieve a 15 or even a 20% weight loss. So we're talking about, you know, extent of weight loss that we had never seen before with older weight loss drugs. And for some people, this is close to what weight loss surgery would achieve. So those are really game changers.
Dr. Morselli, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
That's Dr. Lisa Morselli, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We talked to her about what contributes to excessive weight gain and obesity, how new weight loss and anti-diabetic drugs are telling us about the body's processes around weight and metabolism. I'm Rob Ferret. Check out these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app.